I'm living my fantasy.
What's your fantasy?
Bowie. He represents it all to me. Excitement, space. See, I'm just the space cadet. He's the commander.
Hello and welcome to the much-delayed second installment of my Space Oddity chat with the broadcaster Samira Ahmed. This rather unwieldy release heralds the arrival of a much-postponed new batch of episodes, the first of which will drop next week. Now, here, the story so far, in part one of this adventure, we digressed, deviated, and debated the merits of the 1969 album Space Oddity, also known as David Bowie, Man of Words, Man of Music, or simply David Bowie, to the point at which we achieved full signet committee. Now, as we dive back into this chat, which will match its predecessor in terms of frequent wanderings into what I hope you will find to be intriguing chat byways and highways, join us as we once again take our protein pills and put our helmets on.
And I mean, I must admit, I don't quite understand the lyrics. I read somewhere in the sleep notes that it's his most political song.
This one, really Signet Committee. My take on this song is he's decrying the death of the hippie movement.
Oh, okay.
You know, because he was him at the Arts Lab, then they put on this big festival.
Ooh, the road is coming to its end. Now right. The damned have no time to make amends.
And it's a rather bitter damning of the commercialisation of the hippie dream, of the death of the hippie dream, really.
Infiltrated business cesspool, hating through our sleeves.
But it gets quite ranty after a while. And my problem with this song is that it gets it's like how George Harrison used to do these beautiful sounding songs in which he'd basically tell you off for not being spiritual enough. You know, are you one of them?
Well, the bit that got me was that bit where he talks about the poor, stoned the poor on slogans such as "Wish you could hear, love is all we need."
Mm. Kick out
the jams, kick out your mother, cut up your friend, screw up your brother, or he'll get you in the end.
But then he ends, "But I believe in the path of love."
Do you know, I just think it's a song which is dealing with ideas of the time. Who says it has to have an answer? Equally, I've heard it said that the 60s never got to the suburbs until the 70s.
Right.
But in pockets it did, because
like
you had
this.
People... Yeah, and so in a sense, David Bowie was like that circle of Pre-Raphaelites. You know, there were these circles of artists who constructed a scene around themselves, and if you were lucky enough to be living there, and also not just lucky enough to be living there, but noticed them and chose to walk through the door, it must have been quite an intimidating thing to walk into it.
But imagine the cliques that must have been there, you know, going around and hanging out at each other's houses, going back to someone's house after...
I was just thinking of the men in blazers standing on the street looking at these strange scruffs going in and out of this
long
park.
Hairs.
Yes.
Underneath this all is this wonderful, languorous, shifting melody which kind of like... which accentuates the lyric beautifully, and it kind of like clicks into a 4-4 kind of like gruff, thumping rock riff. It drifts back into this sort of dreamy thing. It's amazing music, and I think... You mentioned earlier about the Observer Book of Orchestration that you saw at the David Bowie years. He used that book, like you said, to teach himself to write music, and then immediately had to give orchestration to the session players.
I was reading that the producer on this, certainly on Gus Dudgeon, didn't read music either.
Mm.
And I know he only produced that one track, but apparently they had to come up with some notation system.
Yeah.
To work out the orchestration for all the musicians, because neither of them read music. And I think it's really
none of the
interesting.
Read music.
Did none of them read? I know Paul didn't, but did none of them read music?
No. I mean, if Paul didn't, who else was going to? Not Ringo.
I just wondered if George might have read music. He was a very good guitarist. Right, should we do Janine?
Let's do Janine.
All right, do you know what to collocate means?
No. Have you heard that word
before? No, we could look it up, couldn't we, on the internet?
I think I even tried looking it up, and the internet just said, forget it.
And it's even put in quotation marks in the lyrics. So... apparently it's about someone else's Malaysian girlfriend.
His friend, George Underwood,
okay.
I think. And the only thing I managed to find about Bowie talking about this song is him saying, oh, that was a bit of a throwaway. A friend of mine was going out with a girl, and it was my way of saying to him how he should treat her.
Yeah, but how did he want him to treat her?
I don't know. That's all I know.
You're too intense. I have to keep you in your place. See, I couldn't work out. Is that... it sounded like he might be... criticising someone trying to keep a girlfriend in their place.
It's a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah. And this thing about I'm like a Polish wanderer, which wanderer would that be?
Are they famous wanderers?
Well, I was thinking of all the famous wanderers, but they're not Polish. Like Peer Gynt is Norwegian. There's the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
But he's who's the famous Polish wanderer?
God, I don't know.
I don't know.
Like a Polish wanderer.
Melmoth isn't.
Could I look at the lyrics? Like a Polish wanderer, I travel ever onwards to your land, and were it not just for the jewels, I'd close your hand. I don't think. See, trying to have a literal interpretation of this is.
Probably not helpful. Just Polish seems a bit specific.
Yeah,
it does. Especially, can I say it's probably my least favourite?
Really? I love the melody of this. I mean, it's got a nice. It makes no sense
to me.
It's
got that bit of a Michel Maibel thing about it, and I hate that one too.
Really?
Maybe just because it's Janine. And Janine is not an exciting name, is it?
It's not an exciting name. It's not a usual name either. When you think of all the names in the world one could use, you wouldn't automatically hone in on Janine.
It sounds a bit French, doesn't it?
Janine.
You could imagine Serge Gainsbourg doing something probably quite Janine, seeing with Janine. Yeah, but that's just as well.
Janine.
No, don't go there. Go there.
Well, not one of your favourites. Definitely one of my favourites. I just love this bouncy, sort of slightly country melody and that little solo at the end.
It's witty and it's quite acerbic, isn't it? So I guess I quite like that. There's all this stuff about to take your glasses off and don't act so sincere. But then there's a bit of a shining moment at the end. You'd like to crush my walls, but if you take an axe to me, you'll kill another man, not me at all. I don't know. It's a bit...
shining moment.
There's a lot going on there.
Well, let's move on then to side two. Time for an occasional dream.
So it starts out hinting a bit Norwegian wood, this discussion of Swedish rooms, of Hessian and wood. But it's just got a lovely folky feel to it. Quite short, it's 2:45. It's
very
proper
short.
Little pop song.
Yeah.
I love it.
But it's very gentle, it's very, like you say, very folky. I think
it changes key quite early on,
doesn't it? I think it also is a song, in as much as his songs are about anything, it's a song relating to Hermione and very nostalgic for. On the one hand, you have the angst of Letter to Hermione, on the other hand, you have this more benign, more reflective, rather sweeter tribute to
her. It's a bit like a Cat Stevens song, isn't it?
Kind of. And you know what? They came up around the same time, I think.
You know, a bit like, is it Father and Father and Son one? It's actually quite, it's got something quite lyrically, musically similar.
Interesting. Yeah, I never thought of that, but you're right. There's definitely a Cat Stevens feel.
You know that song about the father singing to the son?
Yeah. I think in the sweetness of it as well.
I think sweetness is underrated in David Bowie. And because a lot of the songs are quite twisted or they go somewhere quite serious, and they often play with quite discordant chords. This is unashamedly lyrical and sweet, but not cloying.
But do you get a sense from this song of what does it strike you as being sad, wistful?
It doesn't strike me as being happy necessarily, but I just think it's beautiful. I think of all these songs as being like poems, and I suppose it's melancholic. It's a bit, you know, it's reflective on something that's gone. Isn't it? It's about something
very melancholic. I really love that melancholy.
We burnt 100 days. This is a song you'd play after a breakup.
Yeah, definitely. It'd be on my breakup album.
Yes, my breakup mixtape.
On your breakup mixtape. What would be your number one on your breakup mixtape?
Depends what kind of breakup it was.
Say you'd had a horrible. Say you'd been dumped. What would be your number one thing? I think mine would be like songs of anger and rage. So I might start off with. What's that song? I Hate You So Much Right Now.
Oh, well, something by Garbage would be quite good.
A Stupid Girl?
Yeah, something like that.
I'm Only Happy When It Rains. I think I'd have to have a Smith song in there as well.
Oh, I don't know. I feel great about never having got into the Smith. I know what I'd put on. So there's two songs I'd probably put on. I'm not necessarily in order, but the Sandy Shaw song about, you know, the places we used to go. I walk along the city streets we used to walk along with you.
There's always something there to...
Okay, that one. Patsy Cline's song about She's Got You. You know, it's all about I've got your records, I've got
your
class ring. And like, she's got all these mementos, but she's got you.
Yes.
I've only got your stuff. Oh, it's amazing. Basically, I would just put on Patsy Cline, I think, and cry. And there's another one like the Sandy Shaw song, but I quite like sweet songs about breakups.
You like the sort of the more pop...
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I was quite influenced by my older brother, who was born in 63, so from him I got two things. One was an obsession with the Beatles and kind of mid-60s British music, but also that late 50s, early 60s American heartthrob scene. That was partly surf music like Jan and Dean, but also things like Bobby V.
Right.
Huge fan of Bobby V.
Really?
Yeah. So, and one of my big regrets is I really wanted to go out and make a programme with him. He died, I think, last year.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, he was one of those kind of creations of. I'm not quite sure if it was the Brill Building, but I think it was Gene Pitney wrote songs for him.
Gene Pitney was writing songs for him. I'm sure Brill, yeah, he was a Brill.
But, you know, I just love those 60s creations because those boys were, you know, they were marketed at girls, and they were sort of androgynous in their own way. They were incredibly sweet, and they were singing in very specific ways. Like, a lot of his songs are about school, and they're about being kept in detention because he punched some guy who'd been saying something mean. They're very specific, and they're obviously designed to appeal to a whole generation of record-buying teenagers who are this massive new demographic. And I think there's something quite charming about girls having music written to appeal to them, like they were suddenly valued as, even if it was just as consumers, but their emotions and the intensity of teenage feeling being kind of represented in mass media. I think that's lovely.
It was a whole industry, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, like, again, predicates on the taste of teenage girls.
And I think Bowie is very aware of that. So, you know, he really knew his rock history. So when you see that footage of him with all those very, you know, young fans, and they're all dressed like him, he's taken it to a new level where it is androgynous. You know, he is girl and they are boy, and it doesn't matter. And that great shot of him in those giant loose trousers, looking like Catherine Hepburn with his long hair. He looks just like Catherine Hepburn.
From the Hunky Dory era.
Pushing the tram with Duncan in the middle of Beckenham.
And Angie's there next to him. And you can imagine, like, walking along a street and just seeing that in the suburbs.
I mean, I think a lot of what I value is, while I appreciate that their life was complicated and, you know, they split up, but they did actually provide some really positive ideas about how couples could be equal and creative in new ways, and that you didn't have to conform to narrow ideas about gender. You know, she was amazing as much as he was amazing.
That's what we were saying earlier, was that her role in his early success is really underrated now, I think. I mean, she's written off now as being this sort of, like, crazy old...
I think it is changing again. But it's still underappreciated. In their prime. What a wonderful image of being a... You know, there's an exhibition that's just opened at the Barbican about great couples in art. I went to see it yesterday. And it's so interesting how Bowie and Angie actually are much more reminiscent of those surrealist partnerships where they're very androgynous.
Very much so.
You know, they're creating beautiful images as much as music and experimenting and living in a way that suits them. And I think there's nothing except admiration to be had for people living their own way as long as they're not harming anyone else.
Yeah. So this is the wild-eyed boy from Freak Out.
It's funny. In a way, I think
you're really laughing at this one.
Well, I think it can be parodied. It's a bit like a parody of a David Bowie song. The Hangman plays the mandolin before he goes to sleep. There's a kind of lots of little...
Yes, little visual details.
Visual details that sort of seem... One could say they seem a bit pretentious. It's also weird seeing it from a modern perspective, because when I see the word Freak Cloud, it makes me think of the cloud and the internet. It's a completely different
wild
association.
Wild-eyed boy from 1 terabyte.
But it's about the idea of one of those wild children who's kind of been raised by wolves and being brought back into a village.
This, to me, is a folktale. You know, it's like a folk story, right? The wild-eyed boy who runs here and runs there, and I can't remember off the top of my head.
But again, it starts with exactly the same guitar sound.
Same guitar sound.
And so you actually think you're going into Space Oddity, because you can almost hear it starting, and then it sends into this, as you say, more of a middle European,
very much so,
sort of tale.
It's a narrative, isn't it? I mean, you have the lyrics. You can see the sort of he's always like these story songs, and the story song here is quite self-contained, I think.
We haven't talked that much, although we've implied all the way through. You know, Bowie's lyric writing is really remarkable. Mm. You know, he kind of constructs poetic images, throws lines down, they read bizarrely on the page. But it put all together, he sort of delivers them with sincerity. So while I say that, actually there's something quite parody Bowie about some of the lyrics in here. Actually, if you hear the song, you completely take it on its own terms.
Give us some examples then of the couplets here.
Well, it's not so much the couplets; it's just the kind of, you know. There's something about mandolins, which are inherently silly.
Mandolins are just silly.
And the hangman plays. You have to do it with the David Bowie accent. The hangman plays the mandolin before he goes to sleep.
Why are mandolins silly? Why do they strike you silly?
I don't know.
They're quite nice. those things.
No, I don't know. They're actually probably quite Middle European and medieval as well.
It's very medieval, exactly.
Yes.
You've always got a village fool in the corner playing a mandolin.
And the village dreadful, capital D for dreadful, cried as the rope began to rise, for the smile stayed on the face of the wild-eyed boy from Freakland. No, there's nothing pretentious about all of it, but they are weird lyrics. You can't see... There's nothing logical necessarily to some of the words he's chosen, even if they all cohere to give a story. They're more random. They're more random images.
It is. I mean, that's what we were looking at in Signet Committee and in Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed. Rather than a linear narrative, there is a succession of these kind of visual snapshots and these, feelings almost. And he's kind of like painting a story in much more impressionistic ways than just a narrative.
I suppose the silliest lyrics in the whole album are definitely from Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed. In the depth of your banker's spleen, that one. Mm. With a gleam in the depth of your banker's spleen. And the next line, which is, I'm a phallus in pigtails.
I think that was...
And there's blood on my nose. No, this it's not pretentious, maybe. It's just weird. Good for him. I often use the word preapic. Sort of,
yes.
And phallus is a word you don't hear very much outside of literature essays, do you?
Yeah, exactly.
People just say...
Yeah,
what they mean.
Other words. But I don't find I have much opportunity in my day-to-day conversations to use priapic. I do like the word.
Don't you? Every time you look at the Shard, you think, oh, it's a priapic gesture on London skyline.
I didn't see it that often.
No.
Yeah, but when I do. I think it's like a rude priapic intrusion on the skyline. Yes. I think it's certainly not complimentary.
No.
My dog gets priapic quite a lot. So that's...
Don't go talking about that image.
That's probably the most...
I know, I was thinking about tight trousers and pop stars of the late 60s. That was the thing. That's what used to annoy parents at the Top of the Pops. I think they used to just be really furious about how tight their trousers were.
I saw on Facebook...
Very Ruttles thing, isn't it?
Yes. I saw on Facebook the other day that somebody posted a few pictures of Mark Bolan in the late 60s.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And underneath someone said, I didn't realise he was Jewish.
There you go.
Indeed.
Right, shall we move on?
Yep, let's move on.
I feel this sponsor, we're a bit naughty. Right.
Well, we did start off with the wild-eyed boy from Free Club. It ends up in Mark Poland's trousers, so...
Oh, is this good?
Oh, God knows I'm good.
I was walking through the counters of a national concern, and the cash machine...
We'll just jump to the chorus. Just
God knows I'm good.
It's the chorus. God knows I'm good, God knows I'm good.
This is an amazing song.
Really?
Yes.
You like this one?
I love it. I love that it's a catchy little song. It's a bit rockabilly, isn't it, at the start?
Yeah.
And then you realise it's just so inspired by something really specific, which is seeing this old lady caught shoplifting.
I mean, there haven't been that many songs about a pensioner stealing a tin of stewing steak in the rock canon. But here is one.
Isn't it poignant?
It is poignant.
Yeah.
I discussed this album at some point with Nick Pegg, and I was like, I don't like this song. And he gently but kindly alerted me to its many virtues. You touched on the melody here. I think we need that bounce at this point in the album now, because the last few songs have been a little bit on the sort of more
soporific
side. It's got that lovely, that almost Bo Diddley style. Dun 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 dun. But the lyric to me is partly it's Bowie, I think, having a bit of a pop at, technology, automation. And I think, again, in interviews, he said that, sort of cash machines are spitting. And
God, just imagine if you'd known about those serve-yourself tills.
I'm glad that David Bowie never had the indignity of having an unexpected item in the bagging area.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I just think, you see, having said negative things about some of his lyric writing... The thing is, overall, he's just a master. The counters of a national concern. Using a phrase like national concern rather than naming a supermarket chain. It's just brilliant.
It's rather arch, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's so original.
Arch and original. And you know what? When I think a lot of this is to do with his former manager, Ken Pitt, who literally flung open the doors of his bookshelves and told him to help himself. And I think that is really what kick-started Bowie's songwriting, on which we can hear the results of on this album. The previous album, the first debut album, was very... I think he was trying to sort of emulate the Kinks and all those bands. This album, there's a much broader literary palette.
Well, this is, if you think about it, this is a piece of Ken Loach filmmaking in
right,
a song.
Yes.
It's like Kathy Come Home.
It is. It's like a kitchen sink documentary.
Yeah, but it's more it's more artistic than that, because it's he's taken a story and he's taken a moment of the story. Mm. You know, actually seeing her do it, she's slipping the can into the plastic paper bag, and then her being caught, and then, you know, the guy steering her off. And it reminded me of, have you seen the Ken Loach film I, Daniel Blake? There's this really moving scene in it when the young mother shoplifts sanitary towels because she can't afford them, and she gets caught, and he takes her into a room. And I thought that listening to this album again, you know, these moments of degradation, which can be turned into poetry, but also can make us angry. I'm not saying that he was necessarily trying to be particularly political, but it actually is quite a political song.
I think it is. Again, to juxtapose his observations about technology and it sort of this inhuman environment, and in the middle of this very human emotion of pity, of abject poverty, of, you know, this woman stealing.
And it's kind of her perspective. It's sort of told from her perspective. And her,
I love that line about, and, you know, she's taken by the shoulder and gently, and her escort.
She was led away, bewildered and amazed.
Right. And it really is a character who's out of time, out of place, bewildered and amazed by this brave new world around her.
I hadn't thought it that far through. Other than that, I think there's just sympathy for an old woman who's obviously poor at a time. Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, the kind of the cash machines thing. There's something about this song that resonates right now, don't you think? I mean, it's like you could have written this song now.
Definitely.
About austerity Britain. And maybe that's what I love about this album, that a song like that can jump out on its own and have a particular new resonance now. But actually, in the flow of the album, it also sits.
That's very true. That is a song about Britain in 2018 with food banks, with widespread poverty. I mean, that's a very sad reality.
And it's a work of art. It's not just a, you know, it's not a sort of hectoring, sloganeering political lecture. It's actually a beautiful song about a moment and about spotting an artist's eye for a human situation.
And I love that little line, "God can look the other way today."
I know.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant song. Right then, so on to the big finale. Memory of a Thief Festival. And I think there was a vogue at the time in the 1960s, certainly with the Beatles and the Stones, to end albums with a big sing-along, chorus, "Hey Jude, you can't always get who you want." Big kind of, you know, you couldn't really have an album without like the big communal sing-along. And here's this one. Now, the story behind this is quite interesting. Now, there was a big free festival which was organised under the auspices of the Arts Lab in Beckenham. And Bowie was one of the prime movers, I think Mary Finnegan as well, to do this big event in a park or something, you know, lots of musicians, performers and everything. And I think about 2 days before this, his father had died, literally 2 or 3 days. And Bowie obviously was very disorientated and upset. And according to Mary Finnegan, I think in her book, he was in an absolutely foul mood that day. I mean, he was in a really bad mood. He was just bitter, upset, angry. So it's remarkable he writes this song, which is sort of, you know, we had this wonderful day.
Maybe he's just relieved that it's all over.
He's relieved it's all over, yeah, probably. I think Signet Committee came from the same place. That's the flip side, I think, to this song, Signet Committee, is when he's, like, angrily castigating the ideals of the hippie movement and of all his peers. And
see, this is why it's such a fascinating album, because it does give you a sense of time and place, of where and when he was.
Yeah.
And if you want to know what the 60s felt like, I think you sense what the 60s felt like by someone who was at the heart of it.
Exactly.
And
the good and the bad.
The good and the bad. And, you know, just little things like we both recognise the harmonium at the beginning, which is an instrument which is so associated now with kind of Indian music.
Exactly, yes.
And it's sort of, it's a piano keyboard, but you pump it like an accordion.
Yeah.
And it starts with that. Again, I'm just thinking that's Arts Lab sounds coming out of it. And then there's quite a lot about all the famous people who are singing in that big chorus. And then they sort of, what do you call it when you keep putting it on top of itself?
Oh, they overdub.
Overdub it, don't they? To kind of make it bigger and bigger and bigger so it sounds. But there's a big orchestra on it, isn't there?
I think there's a big orchestra. I mean, it was, again, the overdubs were layered on and layered on and layered on, so it sounds massive. But if you listen to the beginning, it has this wonderful sort of slightly otherworldly, magical thing. And again, we return. Again, at the end, we return to this theme of space. You know, he talks about tall Venusians.
About aliens.
And Peter tried to climb aboard, but the captain shook it, and away they soared.
Yeah, well, that's a reference to Peter Pan, isn't it? I mean, he just drops all these kind of great allusions to sort of space and to children's stories in. And you know, I think again about how my children have grown up with David Bowie from a really young age with entirely positive associations and seeing it through their eyes. And songs like Starman, which seem to be speaking directly to them. And I remember my daughter saying, and in fact, she's the first voice you hear on the documentary. She's singing the lyrics to Space Oddity. She was quite young when I interviewed her for it. And asked about her favourite song, she said Starman. It wasn't just the music, it was the lyrics. They were spellbinding. You know, my daughter was something like 8 when she said that.
Absolutely, because in the song he sings, I had to phone someone and I picked on you.
Yeah.
And it's, and on TV when he did that on Top of the Pops, that was the moment he looked into the camera and pointed. And I think a whole nation of kids and teenagers felt funny all over and were like, yes.
That's such a great phrase, feeling funny all over. And I think, you know, there aren't that many. You could probably stop and make a list of people who connected directly through the camera, through, you know, the mass medium of television to the world. And David Bowie's one of them. He does it very, very early on. And he knew it too. Yeah. I think that's the other thing, because he knew it, he then used it. But every time I've seen any videos of his performances, they're always so weird and they're always so daring. There's one of my favourite songs is his cover of the Mersey Beat Sorrow, which is on the Pin-Ups album.
That.
And I first heard that song through his cover version. It was my daughter's favourite song because it's about a devil with long blonde hair. And she had an obsession with Alice in Wonderland, so it was like a song about Alice being sort of devil's daughter. But there's a version of him performing on some show where he's wearing one of those amazing double-breasted suits that's too loose and perfect at the same time.
Oh, I think I know the one you mean.
You know, and then there's this saxophonist dressed like a kind of harlequin, and there's people in scaffolding. And so it's like a piece of surrealist performance art, even just playing that song on a television show. And that would have been, what, 71 or 2 or something?
That was 73.
73. Yeah, yeah. But just to say, if I'm coming on your show, I won't just stand there and, you know, vaguely move around with a mic. I have choreographed an art performance piece for you. And that's how he always appeared. He always appeared performing and not just turning up to mime.
Well, he was an innate performer. I mean, you put me in mind now of a very famous performance from Saturday Night Live. I don't know if you ever saw this, from 1979. And he's basically, it's like a sort of perverted, twisted version of a Berlin cabaret. And he's got Klaus Nomi, the Berlin cabaret artist. Mm-hmm. And they've all got this bizarre thing going on where they're wearing these sort of puppet uniforms. It's very hard to
describe. I think I have seen it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think they do Look Back in Anger. And he's looking great. I mean, I think he looks great in 79, you know.
He looks beautiful.
Really, really good. Like you said, in the Boys Keep Swinging video.
Yeah.
It's that era.
So a bit of makeup.
Very
super handsome.
Very, very handsome. And he's done this very surreal, it's very like Dada, you know.
I was just going to say, like there's Dada puppets. Yeah,
exactly.
Those cubes and
things. That's what it is. And again, this is Saturday Night Live. You know, this is beaming out to middle America.
But isn't that the thing about, you look back at American culture in the 70s, and although we think of Americans being more isolated in some ways, I think there was something that was much more liberal about television culture then. And this stuff was being broadcast. And if you actually look at American cinema making too, it's much more bold. You know, there are a lot of
themes in the 70s.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's, you know, stuff that now would be seen as quite narrow and art house was then quite mainstream Hollywood.
Because we had a far fewer range of choices, really, didn't we? I mean, we had to take our avant-garde and our experimental and our mainstream pretty much on the same narrow band. So there would be a few TV channels, there'd be the cinema, and that was about it. I mean, now...
But if you look about, you think about what was mainstream entertainment, a lot of it was still pretty, you know, old-fashioned and crass, whether it was sitcoms or some of the kind of music and variety shows. If you think about something like that wretched Star Wars Christmas special, which is notorious for having been suppressed by George Harrison, Lucas. That would be such a weird thing. But it's such a terrible, terrible, misconceived piece of television. But that was completely mainstream and normal in 1976. At the same time, you've got all this amazing stuff that David Bowie's doing.
So that was Memory of a Free Festival, which was the big epic finale, and it was sort of ending on a big euphoric note. Without Tony Visconti's influence, without the development of the gang at Haddon Hall and everything, it's possible that Bowie's next album would have been a continuation of this, I think. I mean, he could have carried on in this kind of songwriter, and indeed he did come back to the songwriter vein in Hunky Dory.
How did it do?
It didn't do well. I think it did.
And Hunky Dory's next one?
Hunky Dory, no, The Man Who Sold the World is the next one.
I mean, he comes up with these perfect images,
isn't it great?
The line, The Man Who Sold the World.
Right.
I mean, what a...
Well, the song. The song itself,
but even just the title, just taking that line.
And that's, like we were talking about here, that's The Man Who Sold the World is a great narrative. It's a story. Yeah.
Can I just say the artwork is really mad?
The artwork is mad. I think that's...
It's like George a parody Underwood. Of a 60s druggy album. It's even got a clown.
Let's see.
And it's got a sort of, what do you call it, Hieronymus Bosch-esque bodies writhing as if in the underworld under a table presided over by some kind of rat.
It's kind of horrible. So you have this like king rat, and I'm sure there was lots and lots of esoteric, you know, Buddhist mystic.
Yeah, and there's obviously an alien.
There's an alien there, alien kind of figure. And then there's David Bowie down in the corner looking a bit like Michael Jackson.
I mean, it looks a bit like, as I say, like a parody of a psychedelic album.
The Big Fish.
Yeah, which doesn't actually sell the album that well. I think you'd think it was going to be a lazy imitation to something like Sgt. Pepper. And actually, it's a magnificent work in its own right.
This was George Underwood who did this. His childhood friend.
Okay.
Who, fact fans, was the guy that punched him and caused his eye to
change?
You're right. It's. I don't know. I mean, if that had been the front cover, I think this would have been remaindered pretty much on day of release. I think that's the old woman in God Knows I'm Good.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Being gently
led away.
But doesn't that look like the Scary Monsters era?
Yes. Well, it's like you can see shadows of later David Bowie incarnations, and there's a meditating figure, and there's two spacemen battling with a flower, and then in the corner here. Are they hordes sitting down?
See the mice in their million hordes from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. They look like a prisoner camp or something, doesn't it? They're all in grey. Yes. They're all.
I mean, it's vaguely interesting, but it's not.
What I like is that they half-inched this Vassaretti for the cover, and it's kind of there in the background there.
But it's like the Sea of Holes in Yellow Submarine with David Bowie's face over the front of it. And in that sense, that Yellow Submarine sense of... In fact, if you look, they're even kind of boxes around his face.
I do like this cover, though. When I bought it around the early 90s when they'd just been all reissued. And they had a Ziggy Stardust era photo on the cover, which
didn't
work. This is how it should have been.
Is that a perm?
Yeah, he had an unfortunate perm in...
You say that. I always get very excited when I see people with curly hair.
Really?
Speaking as a person with natural curly hair.
Well, if I had hair, I could empathise. That brings us to the end. So, Samira, do you have any thoughts on the album as a whole, as part of the canon? I mean, do you think that the themes that are in this album would necessarily come back at later stages? Or is it a departure point for Bowie?
I don't know if I've thought it through that far. I just think... For me, this is an album a bit like one of the early Beatles albums, in that it's full of promise and it's beautiful in its own right. And for me, it is like how I feel about roses. I actually prefer looking at a rose in bud to when it's in full bloom, because it's the anticipation of what's to come. And all the seeds are in here. I know that you can hear, you can anticipate future echoes of the orchestration on songs like Life on Mars.
Yeah.
But I think it holds up in its own right. If you put it on, I think you get taken into the mind of David Bowie in 1969, and it was an amazing place and a time to be.
Fantastic. Well, Samira, we'll wrap it up there, but thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for talking about Space Odyssey with such eloquence. I really enjoyed our conversation. And yeah, it's been wonderful having you on the podcast.
Thank you.
There we are, that's that, Space Oddity, as recollected and analysed by the wonderful Samira Ahmed. If you enjoyed this podcast, and really I hope you did, because you're still here, and I'm guessing you've either fallen asleep and left the podcast playing, or you really have enjoyed it, then please do let the world know. You could also drop me a couple of quid at Patreon, where you'll find my online begging bowl at Album to Album. Meanwhile, stay poised, because next week, I finally have the start of a new batch of recordings, so keep an ear out for those. We've got some fantastic guests lined up for that. So till then, thank you for listening, and goodbye for now from me.